Shattering the glass darkly, using brain science to keep us humble. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. So writes St. Paul in Corinthians, the 13th chapter, the 12th and 13th verses. It's a famous biblical passage stating the imperfectibility of human knowledge concerning meaning and purpose. But it does proclaim the certitude that upon death each of us will gain that complete knowledge. I only resonate with the first part of Paul's premise. There is ever so much to know about those grand existential questions, the things while we're alive. When we're dead, I dare not proclaim anything about knowledge. But truly, the video we saw indicates how little knowledge anyone has about those deep things of life, specifically in relationship to other human beings, to our relating to them, about who they are and what they are thinking and feeling. And it goes the other way, too, about what we're thinking and feeling. What do they really know about us? How much dare we reveal? I know from lots of experience in visiting hospitals and being in one a couple times that a hospital has a way of bringing this reality into very sharp relief about our lack of relating to other human beings. It's a place where all human emotions display themselves. Think about it. Everything happens there. As a former chaplain at UCLA Medical Center for a year and a half, working on the oncology unit and working in ER, some dire situations with gang members coming in to actually finish the job of somebody they started to kill before my eyes, and children dying and my holding them after they've died and saying in Spanish in one situation with this poor family all around seeking hope from me, a Unitarian minister, baptizing the child the best I could, and on and on and on. The whole gamut of experiences of human emotions in every hospital, every moment. And yet we don't relate very well there, do we, most of the time? It's a place where we as human beings are forced to face our own vulnerability, perhaps more than anywhere else, to see our loved ones die and to know that someday we will die, and perhaps in a hospital or not, but to own our powerlessness. And sometimes it's a place where we can triumph when there are successes, as there were in this video. The little boy who can now hear, for instance. The father who is expecting a child for the first time. The man who is cancer-free. But often it is a place where we go about our everyday way of being formal and non-communicative with strangers, whether we are a patient, a visitor, or a staff member, doctor, nurse, technician, etc. While inside we might be hurting and in need of love and understanding, whether or not we're a patient or a professional in that hospital. Or where we are bursting with joy and we want to share this with someone, but we so often remain lost within ourselves. And often nobody seems interested in what we are thinking and feeling, and that happens in this church and every church I've ever worked in. Happens everywhere. It's the human condition, and it needs to be changed. We needed subtitles in this video. You would not have known what these people were thinking, nor would I. I don't know what you're thinking right now. I don't know what you're going through right now. How many losses you have experienced recently or just today, or getting on the internet and seeing that another loved one of yours, a friend of yours, has died. And had I not said it, had it not been written, you wouldn't know that I'm going to be a grandfather. I'm ecstatic about that. I never thought that would happen. I want to share that Don't be ashamed to share your joys and your sorrows, especially here. This is a church. This is where you're supposed to do that, if nowhere else. Indeed, I wonder if each of us had a running subtitle that moved across our foreheads, hiding our wrinkles, in whatever language was necessary, and also in Braille with a spoken soundtrack. We have to be completely diversified in this. Again, in the needed language. If we had such a subtitle running across our foreheads, all informing the observer what we were feeling every moment, if then we would treat each other with empathy, if we really knew what was inside the other person's head, would we really know to be empathetic with that individual? If indeed then we would do the task that Einstein calls us to be about, widening our circle of compassion, instead of being stuck with a few friends and thinking that's it and that's the safe way to be. Most of us do not take on such an empathetic approach to life. We don't. We fail in that miserably as human beings. Some of you do, but most of us don't. We hide in ourselves. So why is that about the sense of self? Why does that occur? I wrote this sermon before Maya Angelou died, and I quoted her before she died. And I'm so pleased that I did, because she was a great woman, a great presence. And she said this in answer to my question, most of us do not take on such an empathetic approach to life, and why don't we? She said, we all have empathy, but we may not have enough courage to display it. We're afraid of being vulnerable to others. You know, it is that elevator mentality. I hate elevators. The other day I saw the doctor, right? A checkup. I refused to get on that elevator because I knew I would clam up, even me, as talkative as I am. I would not say a word. So I took those stairs, and by the time I got to the cardiologist, I was like that. So I have to be a little careful about that. You know, I don't know if I believe in God. I've been an agnostic since I first met Roger Fritz. He made me an agnostic. We're going back to 1972 now. I've known Roger a long time. And neither one of us looks any better than we did back then. But it is that elevator mentality that we all have. You saw it in the video. Three people in the elevator. Nobody's talking to the other person. Did you notice they're all, the minute somebody came in, they went like this? We all do that, unless you're crazy, because somebody might lock you up if you start talking to them. Or we think so. So we saw that in the video. The three people in the elevator, nobody talking, each lost in her or his own thoughts. Two men and a woman. Each with a head bowed, not making eye contact, except initially, like, you know, you give a little smile so they know you're not insane and going to stab them to death. But each presumably wanting to have somebody hear what was in her, his heart, presumably. The older man, remember the subtitle? Wife had stroke, worried how he will take care of her. The middle-aged woman, recently divorced. The younger man, just found out he's going to be a dad. Of course, hospitals are not the only place where human beings have an opportunity to relate in a more profound way, but where we constantly fail. It happens whenever we are gathered. It happens in an interesting way during a collective tragedy. I was the minister here, settled minister here, when 9/11 happened. And I remember this place was packed. We all had our flags, even those of us who thought, well, you know, that's just, we shouldn't. But I put my flags on my car. We had to do something together, this collective tragedy, to show it as a group. We weren't ashamed of it. And then time went by. Things change. But the day-to-day connecting with people might not be a tragedy at all, or a high point. It's just an ordinary kind of thing, the person that you love, that you live with. Why don't we connect with them Why don't we keep remembering that we're all here for a very short time? How unfulfilled we human beings are in connecting with each other, and yet we make this choice. We choose to do this over and over again. Thoreau refers to this lost opportunity as well. When he asks us, could a greater miracle take place than for us to look through each other's eyes for an instant? Imagine if you were that other person, just for an instant, that yourself became someone else, just for an instant, to really see what he or she is thinking. Someone who is creating miracles in this regard, you never know where you're going to find a sermon illustration. I found one on April 24th, 2014, when I turned on the ABC World News with Diane Sawyer. And there was a segment called America Strong. Reporter David Muir was interviewing Nick. Nick is a concierge at Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute in New York City. And so for, to the tune of 1,300 a day, people for 14 years, this man named Nick Medley is making miracles. He has shown what he does so well. He gives hugs to cancer patients. 1,300 a day for 14 years. To the cancer patients, to their families, whether or not they want it, and to those staff members, those doctors who don't want to be touched. No, I shouldn't say that. To the staff as well. He does this by simply going up to them and doing it. It is not something that Nick is paid to do. He simply does not stand on formality or depend on a job description. He does what is in his heart. He is an unusual person. He does what his grandmother told him he was good at, what she described to him as a gift, simply to care about another human being and then to show it. Not just to say it, but to show it. And she was the one, and she was sure that he would one day give others hope. Even those who are not big fans of his are converted by Nick. I'm not a hugger myself, and if I saw the man coming, I'd run away. He'd probably run after me. There are people like that who force me to love them in a way. But this is a simple act, one which could get you into a lot of trouble, you know. But then Nick does wear a name tag. So if you're wearing a name tag that says Unitarian Church, you're allowed to hug. But the minute you take it off and go outside, you're not allowed to do that. They might lock you up. Anyhow, perhaps taking a chance of connecting with someone who needs compassion is worth it for the other person and you. You never know. But I do suggest you start off by talking to the person first and moving into the question, can I give you a hug? Some people would really be afraid of that, you know. So let's get to humility. How does this all connect? Nick is someone who is practicing the fine art of humility, recognizing that we are all in this life experience together. And I'm presuming that he also gets a great deal from having those hugs, that we are all merely human. Truly, humility is a spiritual practice in all the world's religions. It's touted as a major virtue in various philosophies. It is, in effect, respecting one's place in context. The term humility comes from the Latin word humilitas. It's a noun related to the adjective humilis, which may be translated as humble, but also as grounded, from the earth, or low, since it derives in turn from humus, meaning earth. Humility means to be humble because we are merely humans. Of course, the word human also comes from humus, meaning earth. So to be humble is to express the quintessence of being human. And reducing yourself to your lowest common denominator and realizing that we're all this lowest common denominator, and by merely touching someone, saying something nice, hugging someone, if you will, shows that we are all in this together. But do not misinterpret the essence of the word to mean self-denigrating. This is where some people get it confused. Often the Catholic Church gets this confused. It's been my experience. When they talk about the sin of pride, the sin of pride, what's wrong with being prideful in a good sense? But listen to what C.S. Lewis says about this. And this is a really great quote. So get your Bibles out and mark it down. C.S. Lewis says, humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. That's a beautiful quote. Humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. Some people have so low self-esteem, they were given the wrong message. Be happy about who you are. Be prideful in that sense. So let's use brain science now to keep us humble. Let's talk about neuroscience. I'm a great fan of neuroscience. I'm not such a fan anymore of theology or of theology, if you will, or of the latest trends. And I don't think neuroscience, studying the brain to see why we're who we are, is a trend. I think it is the wave of the present, and it will continue into the future as we discover who we are. And we, as the scientifically minded Unitarian Universalist types, should really be more apprised of this. I am starting to be. Neuroscience. So think about that question I asked you from this very pulpit last July when we discussed the nature of the self. That question was, who are you, really? Meaning, who am I, really, too? So without going through your rehearsed list, which includes your autobiographical facts, your passions, your dislikes, how many spouses you have had, your social security number, your physical attributes, your astrological sign, your latest disease, which is a lovely thing to talk about here, your financial holdings, your employment history, your marital or non-marital status, your IQ number, your number of offspring, how many grandchildren you're going to have on November 20th, just one in L.A., yeah. Daughter's a lawyer, so's the son-in-law, but you don't need to know that. So let me tell you, without you saying anything about who you are, what I think you are and what I think I am. This is the definition of self or of selves. I'll do so by quoting the words of Bruce Hood from his wonderful book, The Self-Illusion. So hold on to whoever's next to you, or give them a hug, if you will. I don't care. Bruce Hood tells us this. In the science fiction classic The Matrix, our hero, computer hacker Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, discovers that his reality is not real. I wake up every morning knowing that about my reality. He thinks he is living in the United States in the year 1999, but he is living in a post-apocalyptic future world hundreds of years later where humans have been battling intelligent machines. His mundane daily reality is actually a computer program called the Matrix that is fed directly into his brain and the brains of other enslaved humans who are imprisoned in pods and harvested for their bioelectrical energy by the intelligent machines. You get it? We're all machines. But because all experience is so faithfully simulated, the humans are blissfully unaware of their true state. Of course, we are not enslaved humans controlled by machines. But then again, how would we ever know that? How do you know that you're not just merely a machine? If the machine is programmed to tell you that you're something else. Woo. So one thing is clear. Each of us really does have a matrix in our brain. This is because our brains are constructing simulations or stories that try to make sense of our experiences because we have no direct contact with reality. We don't really know what reality is. We only think we do. This does not mean that the world does not really exist. It does exist, but our brains have evolved to process only those aspects of the external world that are useful to us. We only use what is useful to us so that we can construct this sense of self. We only sense what we are capable of detecting through our nervous system. So I know that I'm touching this, but am I really? This is not solid, you know. These are all atoms in here moving around like this. Nothing's solid. The most powerful illusion is the sense that we exist inside our heads as an integrated, coherent individual or self. That's nonsense. Neuroscience says that. As a self, we feel that we occupy our bodies. Few of us think that everything that makes us who we are can be reduced down to a lump of tissue. To this. Are you depressed yet? Should I do it again? As a Unitarian Universalist, I am trying to find out what's true about being a human being. So I'm pushing my own envelope here. I am just a lump of tissue. I recreate minute by minute, second by second, my own reality, and so do you. So who are you really? Who are you really? We have these bifurcated brains, you know. We have this side and that side. And somewhere in the middle, in a normal person, normal intelligence, they connect, and therefore we don't all go stark, raving, mad, and take that animal side and let it go wild. In truth, if we want to believe what brain science is telling us, the answer to the question, who are you really, is simply, we are merely creations of our own imagination. And the self we think exists is merely a lump. Talk about being humble. Of course, theology can say that God has a purpose in this, in creating you and creating me. And who created that theology? Human beings who created their own concept of what it is to be religious. This is what most people go for. But what's real? Talk about being humble when you realize this. And this is a good thing because it's a spiritual quality. That's where I'm going with this. It's a spiritual quality. Humility is. It's touted by religion and philosophy. Except that we now can use brain science instead of religion or philosophy merely, see, to understand that indeed our lack of knowing much at all about who and what we are, the fact that we all seem to make it up as we go along, should indeed keep us humble. We should be humble with this. And with the understanding that we are these self-created selves and ever-changeable, can come absolute wonder at the mystery of creation. I'm sorry somebody walked out on the sermon looking perturbed because he didn't hear that line. Because we can be humble, because we know that we are these self-created selves, we should stand in complete humility and wonder and joy that we were created in the first place. And then you put whatever philosophy or theology you need personally to do that. Humanist, theist, whatever you want to call it. Whatever works for you. That's the Unitarian way. To know that we are here in the first place and that we have the chance to evolve to a higher state of existence. Isn't that exciting that we can learn every single day something new? We can keep going. The brain doesn't have to stop as long as we keep it going. We can do more, as true for our bodies too. We can always do a little more. I sound like a drill sergeant now. With that becomes a joyful, even reverent act. And by reverent, I don't mean anything holy roller type. Reverent because it is steeped in mystery, if not in mayhem, but filled with possibility, no less. Mystery, from the word mystos. That means merely mystery. Life viewed through a glass darkly indeed, but with potential for more and more clarity, for us to create who we want to be, not to accept merely pre-digested beliefs from ancient scholars, pundits, popes, pontificators, what have you. You see, accepting brain science concept that the self is a separate entity doesn't really exist. It frees our mind. What about that? That's a UU classic concept, freeing our mind. It allows us to drop our pretensions and simply relate, to drop what we believe this morning and to create a new concept. That's exciting to ever learn. perhaps to even hug. Ay, yay, yay. I got to work on that one. The words of Margaret Fuller come to mind when she rejoiced at understanding freedom of thought, and she proclaimed her particular ecstasy upon fully embracing a universalist perspective, where the world indeed was her particular oyster, where she did not have to stay in a limited world, one that was filled, in the words of Shakespeare spoken by Macbeth, cabined, cribbed, confined. Said this transcendentalist thinker, writer, critic, activist for the rights of women, and nonstop talker, she was a Unitarian, you see, said she, "I accept the universe." To which the English writer Thomas Carlyle, not a fellow to be persuaded by such braggadocio, opined, "Gad, she'd better." Accept the universe. It's wide, it's waiting for you. Hers was a noble sentiment, one pushing the boundaries of regionalism, i.e., New England for her, denominationalism, politics, and culturally prescribed mores. In other words, one that kept reinventing the self, constantly reinventing who she was. Our grand hugger in the hospital, Nick, has broken through the barrier of his prescribed sense of self, too, the self that society tells him he must be. Society tells us all we must be reserved, formal, and certainly non-touchy. Granted, his grandmother gave him a nudge toward a deeper sense of self, but he was the one who brought what he wanted to be into fruition. One can only wonder what his employers thought of the guy when they first heard that he was hugging people at the door. What would you have thought of him if you were his boss? Lawsuits, perhaps, against the hospital for sexual harassment? Now, can you imagine the Unitarian Universalist Association hiring someone to stand at the main entrance to our Boston headquarters, our new Boston headquarters, and have that person hug everyone who comes in and out of the door? In Boston? Well, perhaps this could happen if the UUA moved headquarters to San Francisco. And maybe they should. At any rate, Nick broke through the barrier. He realized that we are all equal, and in that we should be humble. Indeed, each of us is a made-up self created by our own brain. And because we are so, when we face a time of great crisis, we need not put up a facade pretending that we are more than we are. We can accept the fact that we must be humble, humble in the face of great uncertainty. We can finally be one rather than many. We can be like those referred to in our opening hymn, De Colores. All the colors of people who smile and shake hands and say hello. All the colors, yes, the colors of people who know that their freedom is one. All the colors abound for the whole world around and for everyone under the sun. Y por eso los grandes amores de muchos colores me gustan a mí. I've been living in Mexico for 2 years. So we do not have to stay stuck because it is politic, polite, or posh to do so. Truly, our brains can readjust to create a different self. So why are most of us afraid to connect with another person in a hospital? Brings us back to that question. Maya Angelou suggested his fear. Steve Maraboli, in his book Life, the Truth, and Being Free, suggests judging is preventing us from understanding a new truth. Free yourself from the rules of old judgments and create the space for new understanding, ever new understanding, ever defining the concept of self, of ways of self-creating. And I have to finally ask, aren't these hallmarks of a free thinker? And isn't that what we say? We are free thinkers? That term itself is the classic term. It didn't just apply to Unitarian Universalists, and it didn't just apply to the atheist, as some atheists today think it does. It applied to anyone who wanted to be free from the strictures of an informed, but let me say, limited mindset. The free thinker, then, is on the cutting edge of brain science. That's you, and that is Don Bodrow. We refuse to be entrenched in prescribed doctrinaire ways. You tell me I must do something, I'm going to say why. And I know that about those of you I served as a minister, and there are some people from Venice here to see if I'm still as crazy as I was when I was their minister. One of my mentors for years in this regard of free thinking was that Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius, and he's on the front page of your order of service. This is actually me in drag, dare I say. It's me in drag as a Roman emperor. Beautiful picture of him. You could put him up on your refrigerator so he can remind you that you are a free thinker. Marcus Aurelius, you can see what he looked like. There he is. He was a relativist, as indicated by the statement of his that I have quoted. He says, everything we hear, let me say this again with more emphatic sense of what I'm trying to say. Everything we hear is an opinion. Think about that. Everything we hear is an opinion. It's not a fact. Everything we see is a perspective. It's not the truth. Everything. He's an absolutist on this, although he's a relativist when he's saying it. You get that? It's all relative, but here's the truth. The truth is that you need to be a relativist. It should be related to the situation. You shouldn't be stuck. You should be free to change your mind. For him, there was no one truth. There was an infinity of possibilities, an infinity of ways by which we complex human beings could view so-called reality through our glass darkly. And he lived, he was Roman emperor from 161 to 180. Whoa, we need him back reincarnated. He was, after all, a Stoic philosopher, a member of a school of classical philosophy that believed, among other things, that you could tell who a person really was, that is, you could determine what the person's self was, not by what she or he said, but by what he or she did. I don't think that's the only way to determine what somebody is really like, but it's often a better determinant than to only hear what they have to say. There are a lot of blowhards out there who will pontificate, like I will, and tell you what you should do. But as my one daughter, who's going to be a mother soon, on November 20th, said to me, she said, Daddy, why don't you preach what you, why don't you live what you preach? I hear a particular laugh that I'm very fond of out there, one of my critics. Sorry for the ego trip today. Truly down through time, there have been human beings like the emperor who have shattered the illusion about self that the rest of us seem to have, who have been humble in the awareness that the so-called self is forever in evolution. These have been incredible individuals, and thank the fates for them. They have been way ahead of the curve when it came to challenging the status quo and expanding the mind beyond the commonplace. And this goes for social justice issues and for everything else. And so may we too, each in our own way, stand humble with the knowledge that there is so much more about who we are and what our self can be. And may we not be afraid of creating ever new and exciting vistas for all of us so that we become the self that we think we might want to be. May we be about the task of shattering the lens darkly to shed brighter light on what it means to be alive in the first place. And may we heed the advice of Golda Meir in this process. As she says, trust yourself. Create the kind of self that you will be happy to live with all your life. Make the most of yourself by fanning those tiny inner sparks of possibility into flames of achievement. Thank you very much for allowing me to pontificate once again.